How did you end up leaving school illegally at 15?
Couple of things. So I didn't really decide I wasn't going anymore. I just stopped going in a funny way. So I managed to get a computer. I had a Spectrum Plus 2, which was wow at the time. And, you know, up in the Woodville and the Shangle, there wasn't a whole lot of Spectrum Plus 2s kicking around. But my ma sent me one, and it was just like, wow, I've got a Spectrum Plus 2, and that was me in love. And so I just kind of stopped going to school and wrote stuff on the computer instead. But then I didn't know that you had to go to school legally. So my form teacher, who was a wonderful man, who I'd call a friend today, actually, Lewis Campbell, he's fantastic. And a real credit to BRA. And he showed up at the door one day, and I'm in a towel, freshly out of the bath kind of thing. And he was kind of like, you know, you have to go to school. And I'm like, well, no, I didn't know that. Do I really have to go to school? Like, yeah, it's a legal requirement for children to go to school. And I'm going, you just call me a child.
Man, I've got a Spectrum too. You better wash your mouth out, bro.
I was reading Nature not too long ago. You're calling me a child. But yeah, so we sort of made an agreement that I would go to the school, enter the school, and then if I decided to leave again, that was up to me. So I did that for a while. I had this conversation with Lewis Campbell 5-6 years ago. We had a boozy lunch in Hadskies, and he asked me the same question. He was sort of like, you know, you could have stayed on, you could have done all sorts of stuff. And I was like, look, no one told me the plan. I didn't know
right.
The school to go to university.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that wasn't what happened where I grew up. So all my mates worked in shorts when I was 16, worked in the shipyard. You know, I had a kid when I was 16 and a half. You know, it was a different plan for me.
Mm-hmm.
And plus it was working, you know. And I was using my Uncle Martin's name to get paid. Because I've got the same name. So really I left school because I was earning more than my grandfather. We were making games. We were making computer programs, making games. Me and a guy called Ricky Crawford. And yeah, we were selling them to people, putting them on tapes and selling them to people. And I made a gambling simulator, like a horse racing simulator. It was the talk of the street for a wee while. All that sort of stuff, man.
So how on earth do you not know the path to go to school, but you figure out how to get your hands on a Spectrum 2 and build and sell video games?
Well, I mean, you could do that. That was the thing. You know, I give Ricky Crawford a lot of credit. He lived across the way. He went to BRA as well, went to the same school. And Ricky was genius level. Like, he's done amazing stuff since. And he had a Spectrum Plus 3, of course.
Oh,
this drive, right? You know,
scumbag.
Juicy stuff. So he was doing real pioneering stuff, like really kind of sprite masking stuff and things that were really kind of proper. Whereas I figured out how to write a few things in BASIC. Wasn't that impressive, you know? Although I got into doing music on the computer, which was kind of interesting as well. So I remember doing like Strawberry Fields Forever on a Spectrum. You know, you could do these things.
Mm.
So it was fascinating. And yeah, you know, just kind of roll with it, man. You know, it was a brilliant, brilliant device.
Yeah.
And I just loved it. I just absolutely loved it.
Where does the tech influence come from? Because not a lot of people on the street, I assume, are buzzing to get their hands on a Spectrum 2.
Well, no, but at the same time, you know, you were kind of, there was a wee underground kind of group of people, you know, who recognized what was happening. You know, computers in your house and the ability to create things was profound. You know, and people recognize that, no question about it. Bunch of kids, really. And mostly, like everything in my life's football. It's embarrassing. Like, I had a chat with ChatGPT about how much football I may have watched in my life, and I'm horrified, horrified at the result. But, so there was a game called Brancluff's Football Fortunes. So this is 1987. It was made by a company called CDS Software, based in Doncaster in England, a guy called Giles Hunter, and created by a guy called David Hall, which I now own the rights to and made the remake of in 2019. So bizarrely, I own the global rights to use Brancluff's name and image in a video game. It's just strange.
Great power, great responsibility, Marty.
Well, exactly, yeah. And yes, Nigel Clough has had that chat. But, yeah, so... the thing that was unique about this game, it was the first ever hybrid board game and computer game, right? But six of us could play it at once. So that kind of fostered a group of people who were interested in computers and interested in computer games.
Right.
And then from there, it kind of grew into people who thought they could do this for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first time I looked at a computer, I knew I could do it for a living.
Like what? How?
You create stuff. It was great. It was just obvious.
But it's obvious to you, right? So those two dots connecting together, which is a good definition of creativity and genius. I do believe that. But like, what in your background or what in your mind made you look at that and be like, yep, that's the ticket?
No idea. I mean, my grandfather worked in a... I grew up with my grandparents. My grandfather worked in a mill. You know, there was no background in engineering or anything like that. My family were all ex-army, ex-police. You know, it's not, I don't know. It was obvious. It was just obvious. You know, it wasn't just me. It was obvious. It was obvious to a lot of people.
So that little kind of underground community you talk about, what do you guys start to do and where do you go from there?
Well, you're starting to play games to begin with, and then people are starting to hook up on other stuff, you know, so you're trying to write programs and some other guy knows how to fix it. And, you know, there's a fascinating documentary about this in Siberia, for example, where they couldn't get Spectrums and Commodores, so they had to make them themselves. Now, this is hardcore, right? We were idiots compared to these guys, right? So they were making clones of Spectrum and Commodores. You can still buy them these days, you know, kids in garages making circuit boards.
Mate.
Right? Getting Z80 chips from all over the world, taking them out of fridges, taking them out of everything, right? Real steampunk stuff, you know? And then, amazingly, why didn't we all, well, we didn't have phones in our houses, but some of us did, but some of us didn't. Then they had to solve the problem of, well, how do you get programs over large distances, right? And, you know, we used to tape them, we used to, you know, pass them amongst ourselves in school, etc. They were ringing them to each other.
Are you just serious?
Genius. Well, it's just a baud signal, right? It's just, you know, the old, if you're old enough to remember, right? Well, of course, you can just ring that to somebody else and record it, right? So that's probably the first instance of the internet outside the military. So if you thought of it, he said with no knowledge of all that. That's true.
It's a good clip anyway.
It's a decent clip. You know, it's a good way to get in trouble with the military. But you had an underground network of guys who recorded games, who wrote programs, who passed them around each other, you know, all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was the natural thing to do. We were kids. And if you think of your youngest kid, I don't know what age your youngest kid is.
8 months.
Right. So pretty damn soon, mm-hmm. they're going to be using an iPad like they were born with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was us with Spectrums. It's just how it was.
Yeah, when you put it like that, it demystifies it.
Just made sense.
So where does the back of the sofa money start turning into pocket money, starts turning into... money you can run a car with starts. Are you still waiting for that moment?
well, the schism is having a child at 16 and a half. So there's your schism. So I end up working in KFC and Superdeal Supermarket and Shankill and all the places you have to be in order to earn money with no education. Mm-hmm. So I leave school with two GCSEs. And I leave school with two GCSEs because my English teacher bet me £100 that I wouldn't pass both those exams. It's the only reason I did them. And I got A's in both.
If you could go back in a time machine, you'd be making gambles differently. That's worked out.
Well, Mark Long was a smart man. Yeah,
it's worked out.
He figured me out there, you know, if he paid me. And he did pay me. I met him in the bot for a pint and he paid me. So having Lauren at a very, very young age made things different, you know. So you kind of had a few years of trying to figure just how to get money from anywhere.
Right.
Really, you know. So things fell by the wayside to some degree, but started writing, really, and still did a bunch of computer stuff, but couldn't keep up. You couldn't get the Atari ST, the Amiga. You know, I never got the bigger computer, the PC. Never got those. So you were still stuck with your Spectrum, and your Spectrum was no use at that point because it was outmoded. I started writing. And
when you say writing... Are we talking code? Journalism. We're talking English
creative
words.
English words. Creative and music journalism, effectively, or something. I don't even know what it was.
Right.
You know, you were just kind of doing stuff. Right? And then an internet cafe opened in Shaftesbury Square. And that was just mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing. So my first thing was to try to write a book about Bill Hicks, the American comedian,
mm-hmm.
who had recently died. So it was probably 1995, 96, something like that. And Bill Hicks had died. And the reason that I wanted to do, well, he was a genius, but I got in touch with Kevin Booth, who was Bill Hicks' producer and best friend in Austin, in Texas. And he runs the Bill Hicks Wildlife Foundation, which he donated all the money to after he died. And so I naively tap off an email to Kevin Booth going, "Hello, I'm Marty from Belfast, and I want to write a book about Bill Hicks." And he went, "Well, I'm already doing that." And I'm like, "Okay, well, that's shot in the foot." But there was it was a magazine half a mile away called Blank Magazine, music magazine, and there'd been like maybe two issues out or something. It was our only local music magazine. There was Blank and there was That's Entertainment, but That's Entertainment was bloody awful. Sorry, Lynn, but it was terrible. Colin Murray and Paul McNamee were running this magazine. And they put Bjork on the front cover of it. And I was like, "You two idiots." Sent them this big email, just basically calling them idiots and telling them we should have had Bill Hicks on the cover and all that sort of stuff. So they invited
me. Man, you really liked Bill Hicks.
Oh, man. It changed my life.
How did it change your life?
Oh, jeez, you know, you familiar?
A little bit, but not much.
Well, spoonful of sugar makes a medicine go down, I guess. You know, if comedians are the truth tellers of our age, right?
Right.
You know? So Hicks had a way of taking extraordinarily complex philosophies and ways of looking at the world and making them funny and palatable all at once. And if you were a teenager in the middle of the Shankill, you know, he was just so smart. He was, Richard Pryor called him the prince.
Mm.
And when Richard Pryor's calling you the prince, that's, you know, you're the best.
Yeah.
You know, and of course he dies at 33, so his legacy's perfect, right? All that sort of stuff. So yeah, fired off an email to these guys, furious email, and they got invited to come down for a chat and went down to their office in Howard Street, ready for a fight. You were like, so yeah, you go down to their office, and it's the smallest office you've ever seen. Like it's a broom cupboard in Howard Street.
Like bigger than this?
Quarter
the size of this?
Yeah, you're talking like five square meters.
Unbelievable. Like it's so it actually ridiculous. Is a closet?
It's a closet. And they're both sitting there furiously hammering away at like articles and stuff. And I come in, and Paul McNamee's just, he's just attitude like, encapsulated in human form anyway, you know, and the two of us have a bit of an argument, and then he's like, do you want to write for this fucking thing or not? And I'm like, I'm paraphrasing. I think I said something like, you obviously need somebody who can. He told me years later that he'd seen my girlfriend, that that was the only reason he entertained me.
That's so funny.
And I became a music journalist at that moment. And again, like, you know, we chatted a wee bit before we started recording about tiny rooms and people in tiny rooms and how these tentacles go out into the world and do amazing things. So in that tiny room is the first time I met Stuart Bailey, who had the OEA Music Centre with Gary Lightbody from Snow Patrol, you know, just all this stuff in one tiny 5x5 room.
Mm.
Because these guys were bonkers enough to start a music magazine in Northern Ireland.
Right.
It was a reckless act of mania to do so in 1993, I think, 94. It's dangerous, actually, in some ways, but they did it.
Mm.
And they were the perfect team of, you know, cross community and all that sort of stuff. Colin from Dundonald, Paul from Ballymena, but, you know, uber Catholic. And yeah, they were a great mix, absolutely great mix. And that then started me on a pathway to just bizarre happenstances that end up as companies and music centres and
tiny rooms
always
the tentacles going out of tiny rooms.
Yeah, the right people in tiny rooms.
I love that
for sure.
So how does tech come back into your life?
Okay, so Blank Magazine and Richard Deal, who we discussed years later, I go to work for as well. They're trying to build a website for Blank Magazine and they're doing it really badly. Actually, it was okay for the time, but I was kind of, I can definitely do better than this, so we'll figure that out. So figured out how to do a website for them, and then Stuart Bailey had come back from London. I'd gone to do this journalism course, an MVQ,
first time I met David Holmes again, tiny rooms, you know. So yeah, he kind of went, do you know how to do web stuff? And I'm like, I didn't really, but he said yes. And he said, look, I'm going to do this thing called OHYEAH.net. It's going to be like the first Irish music website. Brilliant, let's do that. And we did that for like 5 years, and that was cool. And that became the OHYEAH Music Centre further down the line. So there's just this thread of amazing people.
Yeah.
You know? And you see in Belfast, we're so bad at like recognising just how many amazing people we have. We don't have amazing facilities or infrastructure sometimes. The people are fucking special.
Mm.
Right? And anyone who's been away for a while knows this in their heart. And when they come back, they're fucking relieved that it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
You know, Bailey's an amazing guy. Lightbody, David Holmes, Colin Murray, Paul McNamee, Colin Carberry. All these people, all from a tiny room. Nobody made any money. Did I ever get paid? I'm not even sure I ever got paid. I never thought about it.
So how are you making that work financially?
Not.
You're still doing the KFCs? You're still doing the...
No. I'm probably unemployed at that point, technically.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm unemployed at that point.
Yeah.
Technically. Well, I mean, I wasn't getting paid, so...
Sure.
I guess I'm actually unemployed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was unemployed for probably about a four-year period.
Yeah.
I would say before I figured out that you could just start companies, really.
And once you... How did you figure that out? You just started one? You're like, oh, here, that's how it works?
It's funny, you know, Chris McClellan used to do it.
Yeah.
And we used to do this thing with school kids where it's like, you know, you just do stuff.
Mm.
You know, anyone that says they have a plan, it's never the case, right? Mm-hmm. Really. So you just do things. And how did I then? Yeah, so we did OHYEAH.net, and I started doing stuff for the BBC, and I picked up a bit of work for the BBC. And an ex-girlfriend of mine was a producer in the BBC. And she gave me some work. She took pity on me.
That's how it works.
Yeah, exactly. Certainly in the BBC at that time, anyway. Yeah, so you just do enough stuff to start being recognised. And then people go, well, okay, would you like to do this? And you go, well, I need to be paid this. And they pay you. And that's the genesis of every self-employed person, I believe. And then I go to work for Bright Star Records. So Stuart Billy's best man and best mate, Johnny Davis, comes home from London. And another friend of mine, Darren Smith, then, Colin Murray initially, but then he goes to Radio 1. And Darren Smith goes to work for Bright Star Records. And of course, everybody dreams to work for a record label. So Darren then goes and finds me, and I become the tech guy for the record label, and a kind of half hour guy for the record label, and a bit of everything for the record label, you know, how these things work. And again, Gary Lightbody comes back into the picture because Snow Patrol get dropped by Jeepster, their label, and he's done this super group called the Reindeer Section, and we put out the Reindeer Section record. So it all just kind of moves around, and Nathan Connolly, who's now in Snow Patrol, was in a band called Fuel on our label, and, you know.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Well, me and Darren pretty much physically dragged him to the Snow Patrol audition, which he wasn't going to go to, he said. He went. So again, tiny rooms, and this was just a wee room up in Carrie Duff this time. And, you know, Johnny had come home with the intention of, you know, really doing something special in music in Northern Ireland. And Bright Star's a footnote, but it's a very important footnote, you know. Very, very important footnote. And I still see its impact today, which was great. So I did that for a couple of years. Then we went and did the OHYEAH website for real. And we were starting to make some money there. OHYEAH.net was starting to make some money. And then I spun out a web design company because I knew how to do it by then.
Yep.
And I knew enough people that needed what we were doing. And that's, yeah.
I think it's amazing how, like, I still am fascinated by how, like, it just seems like tech was always in you. Like, even at the point where it's like you're working for Blank and they're like, and you're looking at a website and you're like, you're not doing that right. And it's like,
yeah.
Who are you? You know what I mean? It's like, what websites have you built? Do you know what I mean?
I am no one.
But it's crazy how you just like had that in your brain where you're like, I could do that. Or again, you know, they're asking, here, can you do a website for this company? You're like, yeah, of course you can.
As long as you're willing to say yes to things that you believe you can figure out.
You ever said yes later to something that you just absolutely, it just fell on its face. It just was not figure outable.
No. No, because, you know, if you follow what you're interested in, right? And if you're lucky enough to be able to get paid to do interesting things,
right?
You have no real excuse. In my view, it's like, you know, the definition of hard work is not long hours. It's work that's hard to do, right? Do you know? So for me, I've never had a job, man. I don't think of myself as having a job.
Mm-hmm.
That would give me terrible, terrible anxiety if I thought I had a job, I think. So I've never really considered myself to have had a job.
Yeah.
From I left McDonald's or KFC, I would say.
Yeah.
Which is pretty damn good.
It's pretty good.
And I also, someone asked me, I was at a Catalyst, of course, someone wants me to be a mentor. It's like, right, you might regret that. That might be the thing that falls flat in its face is me being a mentor for Catalyst, let's see.
I'm sure but, you'll figure it out, Marty.
Well, I mean, I've done it in Rays. I've done it in Rays, but I'm not the most compromising person at times. So, you know, if I can mentor you, you were mentorable by me, right? You know, this type of thing. But someone asked me to kind of podcasty format thing they're doing, and they said, look, what does success look like? And it's like, I would time it by the last time you set foot in a dole office.
Mm.
You know, that's my timeline, that's my measurement. I haven't set foot in a dole office in 27 years probably, and that wasn't supposed to happen. So
what are you up to now?
Okay. It's a bit of chaos at the minute. Well, so we still got AirPods, which is my kind of main drag.
Mm-hmm.
I was Raise Accelerator for a number of years, stood down last September, plant. It's kind of too busy, you know, just too thinly spread, wee bit. And we're doing Belfast First Retro Arcade, which should open in June, July, in what used to be the old Frames building.
Wow.
In Library Street. Yeah, so yeah, it's pretty cool.
Actually, I had no idea about the arcade.
Oh yeah, we've done it for the last year, pretty much, in the OEM Music Centre. So there's a pop-up retro arcade. So it's 80s, 90s, authentic 80s, 90s machines, pinballs, and we pop it up once a month in OEM. But yeah, we're going to go and do it for real, absolutely.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And like I said earlier, we're all just teenagers with adult income. what else would you do? You know, it was a notion in the middle of the pandemic to go, can we do an arcade? You know, Belfast, I always think in terms of Belfast deserves X.
Mm-hmm.
Belfast deserved a music centre.
Mm-hmm.
Belfast deserves an arcade. I don't like it that we don't have things that other people don't have.
Sure.
Or other people do have, sorry. Yeah.
You think the market's ready for an arcade? Is Belfast ready for an arcade?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. 100%.
Talk to me.
I've yet to meet anyone that's not excited about it. You know, and that's from, you know, age 13 plus, you know.
It's a great location for it.
There's a great location. It's Dave Neely, who introduced me to my wife, pretty much, you know, used to run the Limelight. So again, small room, Colmar used to work at the Limelight. You know, all these little, you know, Belfast being a village, and it is, it has great advantages,
mm-hmm.
great advantages if you know how to kind of be part of it
mm-hmm.
as such, right? And you help, and, you know, you're willing to chip in. So, yeah. So Base Arcade will open June, July.
Class.
Yeah. It's great. It's really cool. It's really cool. I mean, my morning, you know, is typically now shipping notifications from all over Europe.
All the machines are arriving.
Various big boxes. Yeah.
Assembled.
We've got a ton of them already. We've loads of stuff going on. Like it's a hobby, really. It's a fun business,
mm-hmm.
you know. But at the same time, I definitely think Belfast deserves a retro arcade for sure.
Class. So AirPods, at what point in your journey does that start kicking off?
Interesting. So in 2009, we've got the web business and we're pretty successful. We're doing very well. But I'm a bit bored.
Service-based, bespoke.
Correct.
Clients.
All that.
Right.
It's all become a bit predictable.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the creativity's gone out of it to some degree, because that's the thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the creative part, you know.
Where are you based? Where's your office?
In the OEM Music Centre.
There you go.
Which we made in 2005, mm-hmm. pretty much. 2007, sorry. We started making it in 2005 and opened in 2007. So we're in OEM. And yeah, I mean, it's all very good, but it's all a wee bit kind of Yeah.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine, Robert Holmes, my very, very oldest friends, we do the, we'll go for one after work thing, mistake. And Paddy, who owns Backbeat Records, who used to be Terry Hooley's partner in three or four of Hooley's Good Vibration shops, I think, who knows? Nobody knows true history, not even Terry. He has Backbeat Records in Haymarket Arcade, and he's going to Germany. He's had enough. And me and Robert looked at each other and said, what are you going to do with the shop? He said, well, throw the keys in. And I says, come to me. And he's like, across the table. I was like, now we got a record show. We're going to do that. So Robert was, he's unemployed. He'd left the building sites by this point. So he was kind of thinking, you know, he's a musician. You know, let this be. Why not? You know, didn't give it too much thought. So we find ourselves with a retro record shop full of vinyls, all single vinyls, you know, stock of one for everything. And I, of course, then I'm the tech guy. So I go, right, well, we need a way of selling online. It's how we rescue this business. We sell online. And I went looking for point of sale system that could hook up to an e-commerce website. None. Not one in the world.
What year is this?
2009.
There's not one?
Not one in the world.
That's carnage, man.
Yeah. So I dart around to our office, and in 10 or 11 minutes it took me to get from Haymarket Arcade to Gordon Street in the OES Centre, I decided to shut the agency in. We'll do this. Yeah, they were a bit shocked.
I bet they were.
Some came with me, others didn't.
Yeah?
Yeah, that was it.
So lay out the problem for us, just like crystal clear, black and white. You've got a brick and mortar business, and you need to be able to take payments.
Well, so in this case, you've got a brick and mortar business and you've got a stock of one for pretty much everything, because they're genuinely retro vinyls. Mm-hmm. You don't have two of each. You've only got one. So if someone buys it in the shop, it's got to be sold online. If someone buys it online, it's got to be sold in the shop.
Right.
You can't sell it twice.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that problem, which we were making e-commerce websites for lots of people. Like, we did Apache Clothing, again, Snow Patrol, they wore Stop Wars and the Spitting Games video, Tiny Room. Right. And Stevens, who went on to work with all sorts, you know, all just the same tiny room,
pretty much
transported into different buildings. Smith and Gibson, you know, we were e-commerce specialists, almost. I wouldn't say we really were that good at it, but we were pretty damn good. And so we already knew how to get the selling online, but what we didn't know was how to bake it into your business. Mm-hmm. We'd never thought about that. So we were actually part of the problem. We were causing people the problem that we ended up in our bus, then solve them down the line. Yeah.
Mad.
Yeah, so what first is it? World.
11, January, 12 minutes, world. And you just decided, that's it. But again, like, why? Like, it's like looking at the computer. It's like, what in your brain just goes, yep, this is it, let's just go.
Well, the opportunity was like, it was like fireworks went off in front of your eyes.
Hmm.
Do you know? And Robert was looking at me like, well.
Yeah, what's the big deal?
I'll be back. And I bombed out of the place. Do you know? And he was like, you know, used to me doing these things. We've known each other since we were kids. But yeah, it was so obvious. The opportunity was just so obvious. We were just like, wow, if we can solve this problem, this is going to be huge.
Mm.
You know? Yeah, that was it. And it was obvious. It's one of those things where you go, like, I'm in the Ormond Bath a few weeks ago and I'm doing a thing for SideQuest. And you're going, why didn't I think of this?
Mm.
One of those ones, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was the one I thought of, you know. And yeah, it's ever since, it's been kind of, it's been a good journey.
Sure.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about, like, who your customers are, like, what types of people use AirPods, how's it gone over the world?
Mostly retail, and, you know, guys who want to sell online, basically. So people who understand the problem as such, you know. We would have been a lot bigger 4 years ago. I mean, the pandemic was absolute, you know, kind of extinction event for us. If the customers hadn't continued to pay us, we were done. Because obviously all retailers all shut their doors, and we get paid via payments, right?
Right.
So yeah, extinction level event. And we actually did. We stood outside the Duke of York on day before St. Patrick's Day, March 16th, 2020, and that was it. As far as we were concerned, it was all over. you know. But we're back on our feet. We're probably halfway to where we were. And the investors were great. They're very kind, you know, kept it rolling for us. Customers, we lost about probably 20% all told. But what really happened was most of them got a lot smaller.
Right.
So we were kind of high-fiving and going, oh, we've kept 80% of the customers. But it took us 6 months to realize how much smaller they all were. So coffee chains that had 15 outlets, we're now down to two. You know, that's the real story of the pandemic. It's not the businesses that closed. The businesses that contracted and never went back up again.
Right.
That's huge. So that happened. That happened to Airbus in a big, big way. Big, big way. And of course, our competitors, pandemic did not happen to Square. Right? You know, I'm sure if you asked them, there was a pandemic. Was there? You know, no offense to Jack Dorsey, but I don't think he was overexposed to these things. So yeah, you came back out of it weakened, really, and you know, kind of having to rebuild. But it was interesting. So in the middle of the pandemic, I got an approach from a very big challenger bank who were looking for the systems that we had. And I've had a few approaches over the years about selling the thing. And, you know, this one was crazy. It was like every Zoom call was like seven M&As on it.
Right.
You know, mergers and acquisition people who, no offense, them all sounded like they were coked up in the afternoon. They were going like, boys, calm down a bit here. That's just me and seven of yous going, right, you know, and I'm the only one on the other end of the line here. So it was interesting. And, you know, they made an offer. It was kind of derisory. And you were sort of like, do we want to do this to ourselves? Board were, no, absolutely not. We're not having that, you know. Okay. And, you know, never really even put the offer to the board. It was so poor, you know. And they were, you know, to some degree, they were being predatory. I get that. I understand. It's business, right? But yeah, then the thing that was interesting was that they were only interested in the volume of card payments going through the platform, which we'd never really looked at that hard. You know, idiots that we were. And then when we went and looked at it hard, we went, oh my God.
Right.
You're idiots. We've got a subscription business. We need to have a payments business.
Yes.
You know, and our PostPay was born. And 2 days later, we got a phone call from Stripe. So I'd been talking to Stripe for years about the same thing. Every 6 months, she would pop down to Stripe and go, hey, guys, terminal payments, card payments, anybody thinking about this? Oh, yeah, and they're great. You know, they'll give you the time of day down to Stripe, always. And then, yeah, phone call. Oh, yeah, we're releasing Stripe Terminal. When are you doing that? Okay, just send the contract. Seal, done. Just send the contract. The contract makes sense, we're in. And that's what we did. So we hooked up with Stripe, and they're fantastic. I mean, they're just brilliant. They're just absolutely great. So yeah, it's been a rebuild, really, and a kind of rocky road, really.
Sure.
You know, but we're stabilized. We're starting to grow, you know, which is good.
I love how it's the dark eye of the storm. Mm-hmm. And then just speaking to the cooked up M&As, where it's like...
Allegedly,
yeah. I think Daniel said that, didn't he? Daniel, you've been talking too much this episode, bro.
Yeah, yeah.
I love how it's that. It's like one of those, what's it like? It's like the moment in the McDonald's movie, The Founder.
A wee bit. Yeah, not quite that profound, but yeah.
It's like, do you realize what business you're in? It's like, you're in the volume of card transaction business, bro.
Well, you learn, Matthew. You know, the one thing the pandemic will teach you is it doesn't love you back.
Mm.
No matter how much you love it, it will never love you back. It can't. It's a machine.
Right.
You know? So yeah, you know, someone said to me, well, I can't remember who, but someone said to me in San Francisco, just make sure the thing you own doesn't end up owning you. I never forgot. Like, that's ways. And at the worst moments, you go, oh, fuck that. That thing's not going to own me.
Right.
I can always do something else because, you know, ideas are the currency, really. Mm-hmm. Ideas are the real currency. This is what I tell the founders and Riz. You know, if everybody had ideas, no one would be an investor. Right? Ideas are the real currency.
Right.
Currency follows the real currency. So I've always thought, arrogantly or not, I'll still have a good idea. So, yeah.
It'll never love you back. But that is interesting because, like, we as business owners, we love our things too much.
Yeah.
I don't. I really don't. You know, I can't. Hurts too much. You couldn't do it. You know?
When did you really get your heart broken?
But you have so many problems, you know. I'm not even really sure I like the term startup founder, you right. know, or entrepreneur or any of that stuff. I mean, that's fine, you know. You've got to have some descriptive term. You have so many problems that having the emotional problem is maybe the thing I believe tips people over into damage.
Tell me more.
You get damaged anyway. If I loved this, it would break my heart.
Mm.
It would have broken my heart in pieces by now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, it's broken my body in some ways. Right? It's broken my mind in some ways. It's never broke my heart.
Mm.
And I don't think it could. If it went away tomorrow, it wouldn't break my heart.
That's very, I would say, on my limited experience, rare to find someone who can say that confidently.
Maybe it's just experience. Maybe I've just been around the block a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I've had failures, you know. And when you've had failures, depending, failure's all relative, of course. But, you know, when you've had failures, you know this thing. Like, you know, the OEM Music Center would have hurt me a lot more because I loved it.
Mm.
Right? Now, it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if it had a tanked, that would have hurt.
Right.
Not for me, particularly, probably for the 16-year-old me who wouldn't get to walk in there, which was the whole reason for doing it. You know, I think software businesses are maybe different, Matthew. You know, you don't meet the customers, you don't get to know them, you don't.
Right.
You know, you can't claim to be their best mate. You've never met them. You know? So it doesn't seem surreal to love that. Love something that's not there.
I think the world's getting a bit more like that. We're increasingly having things in our life that are just not really there, as you say.
Yeah, Jesus, we're in the Matrix.
We are.
We're genuinely in the Matrix. We're increasingly, my wife's telling me this morning, like 10 hours on my phone, I need to change this. It's like, when are we going to do it? You know, we know better. We come from a place before all this.
Right.
You know, 25-year-olds don't know. There used to be a time when you didn't do this.
Yeah.
Now, your scream is different. All right, you know, so you know, what was the disposable heroes, you know, television, the drug of the nation, reading ignorance and spreading radiation. You know, we've always been staring at screens.
Right.
Everybody under 50 has been staring at screens. But, yeah, I mean, the connection piece, you know, that kind of ability to connect is different. And someone said to me, we talked about this a while back, young people have two lives. They have their online life, their idealized kind of muse, and then they have their real life. And somewhere in between lies the person.
Mm.
And if you know anything about anxiety, which, you know, if you're a startup founder, you probably do, right? Being in the in-between is the devil. That's where you don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be somewhere, never in between. And I wonder how people balance it, you know. And if you fall in love with that other life, then
it really is the Matrix.
Yeah, you know, you've lost some, you've lost yourself.
What do you call that guy in the Matrix who wants to be put back in?
Well, I don't know which one.
Cypher.
Cypher. Oh yeah,
is that his name?
Yeah,
he wants his mind wiped, and he wants to be put back in.
Well, because he's just given himself to the idealized muse, right? He's become, you know, I think as Guy Debord, Society of the Spectacle was the idea that everyone would become famous for 15 minutes. That wasn't Andy Warhol, that was Guy Debord.
Hmm.
And the book is really about how people become projections of themselves. And that was written in the 70s, you know. And yeah, you know, that's where we're at. We are projections of ourselves. You know, is my life what you see on my LinkedIn? No, fuck no. Fuck no. My morning today was not what my LinkedIn will say it was.
Right.
And that's not lying necessarily. You know, you're promoting a business. You're promoting, you know, you're marketing.
Yeah.
But surreal that you're marketing yourself, right?
Being in between is such an interesting concept.
Well, who are you if you're marketing yourself? You know, that's a very, I've dealt with a lot of young people in the Raise Accelerator, and it's like, I mean, you know, maybe too far is why nobody really wants to be their mentor. But, you know, you have to be hard about that and say, look, it's a business, right? it serves you, not the other way around. Okay? And if it doesn't serve you, it has no purpose. Right? And if you fall in love with this thing, it will not love you back. It won't. It can't. It's a machine. Right? It's like falling in love with an android.
Mm.
Don't do it. Watch the Orville. Doesn't work out well. You know?
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Why Belfast? Why'd you stay in Belfast?
I left for a while, but not very long. So a couple of periods of just back and forward, London, San Francisco and things. But I wrote a thing about Van Morrison once for NI Music Magazine, which I was the editor of. Forgot to talk about it earlier. It's another thing that happened. And I remember having the thought that I don't want to die anywhere else apart from looking at these hills.
Mm.
And so I've been asked that question a lot because a lot of people think someone like me should leave. And the answer really is, so to come from where Belfast has been, right, which I remember profoundly. I grew up in Tweddle Avenue in the Ardoin interface. Saw a lot. To be where Belfast is and where Belfast is going, right? What better life could you lead than to see that? Where else could you go that it would matter more to see the end of it? Do you know?
Mm.
Now, does that limit your choices? Yes, it does. It's not San Francisco. It's not London, right? But can you make an effective change in the place to make it better for the next guy? Next girl? Yes. And that's your fucking responsibility.
Mm.
Do it. Right? Don't moan about it either. Do it. Or don't do it. Go to San Francisco. It's great.
Sure.
You know? But I think to see that thing through, to be an elder out the other side of that, that's profound. That's amazing. You know? To see it go from darkness to light. Mm. Yeah. I want to do that.
Where do you think Belfast is going?
Even in the midst of the conflict, Belfast was great. You know? And that sounds so weird. Like, I remember having lengthy arguments with Newton Emerson years and years ago about why Tweddle Avenue was great. He was going, really not? And it's like, no, it is. It's like message board days, right? And it was. It was great. Now, it had all the bizarre elements of, you know, where I grew up, you could never go to the left. You weren't going to Ardoin for anything, right? You know, if you were told that there was £1 million across the road, you weren't going, right? It wasn't happening, right? You always went to the right, down to Shankill, down to Woodville. But the people were the thing, you know, and anywhere the people are the thing. Do you know, why would you go to San Francisco? You go to San Francisco because you can walk into a cafe and meet 25 people like you, who think about companies the way you do, who think about commerce the way you do, who think about largely life the way you do, although they'll all think owning guns is all right for the most part. That's even your most liberal American believes that to some degree. But, you know, you're kind of looking for your tribe. Well, your tribe's here, do you know, and they're fucking great, you know? So for me, if Belfast can reverse the brain drain, which should be all of our mission, and things like the Orma Bass that we're sitting in right here would be instrumental in changing it, then you can have a very special place to live. Very special. Because the special element is the people.
Mm.
You know, the politicians can fuck it up all they like.
Yeah.
You know, when the government collapses, are we all like running about with our heads on fire? We're not really. We're not. And that's great at the moment to see Michelle O'Neill and, you know, Emma Pengelly. Who would have thought this was going to happen? This is the next Chuckle Brothers. Who would have thought that was going to happen? But the thing is, it's not that important.
Right.
You know, it's not like we descended into chaos
the
minute they weren't there. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Resilient people continued to do what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Continued to try. Continued to kind of chip away at this thing to make it something better.
Yeah.
I love Belfast. I absolutely love it.
Do you feel like Belfast has loved you back?
No, but it doesn't. It doesn't in some ways. I mean, you know, you talk about the kind of the conflict and things like that and the terrible impact that had on all sorts of people.
So I remember talking to a psychiatrist. I went to a psychiatrist because I thought I should, you know, thought that was probably a good idea. And we were talking about where I grew up, and she said, what did it feel like? And I said, it felt like being haunted.
Mm.
And that is what it felt like. Every time you left the front door, it felt like being haunted, you know, and very hard to get unused to that idea.
Right.
Right. So people my age, I'm 47. A lot of people my age are running around with their heads on fire still, you know, with like 360 cameras in their heads, wondering who the guy standing behind them in the coffee shop is. And I was doing that 10 years ago.
How'd you turn that off?
CBT. You learn techniques. You're taught how to recognize that those feelings are normal. But the guy in the coffee shop doesn't give a toss about what you're doing. He's in his own wee world. You know, all that sort of stuff. And that was necessary, you know, and I've seen it, and my friends have seen it, you know, it's necessary, really necessary to unlearn that feeling of being haunted. So in some ways, Belfast has been appalling, appalling, but what you learn, you know, everything becomes easier out the other side of a conflict.
Right.
It must do. It must do. Nothing will ever feel that way again. And that's a great thing. And, you know, for young people, I'm not saying they don't have problems. They absolutely do, because their generation is different from mine. But they can be glad they never, ever, ever had that feeling walking out their front door, going to school or going to the shop or whatever you had to do that day. You did it with a target in your back. And it felt that way. So, yeah. And also at the same time, the greatest people I've ever met have met in this city. And I love them all dearly.
And only some of them love you back?
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. Do you know? I don't ask for it, I guess. You know?
You love Belfast without an expectation that it will love you back? And you love it because you have something deep inside of you that says it's a responsibility of mine to lay one brick, two bricks in the wall that will be the future of this place?
Well, look, it gives you a blank canvas and it gives you a level playing field. To a large degree, right? And you don't get that anywhere else. You're not getting that in London. That ain't happening. Unless you've got mega wealth for a start, right? Could I have started a business in London? I'd have died in the ditch in London, man.
I always said, everyone, if I started this podcast, I live in New York. If I started this podcast in New York, it wouldn't last three episodes.
You're toast.
I'd be dead.
Right. You'd be doing it on the subway.
100%.
You know what I mean? On the way to your third job. You know, it just wouldn't happen, right? Yeah. So a level playing field that shouldn't be underestimated. A lot of people put that down and you kind of go, right, okay. And, you know, when people go, oh, blah, 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 Belfast, well, what the fuck are you doing about it?
Right.
What are you doing about it? Why are you sitting moaning at me? I have stuff to do. Seriously, I have stuff to do. It's not like I'm going to live forever, right? I'm not Brian Johnson. It ain't happening, right?
Such a niche reference.
It really is.
I didn't get it at the start. I was like, oh, that guy. Okay.
You know, I mean, that's the thing, man. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, well, you know, get on and do something about it.
Because
you'll get the opportunity. Belfast will give you the opportunity.
Yeah.
Because it has so many places that need fixed. And so many things that need done. I mean, this is great.
Well, as you say, you know, like entrepreneurship is really solving problems. And if there's a place where there's a lot of problems, then there's a lot of opportunity, isn't there?
That's the difference between an old and a new house. You know, everyone tells you a new house is great. You lived in New York, everyone told you a new house was going to be great, right? And then, a big crack appeared in the ceiling. And that wasn't meant to happen in my new house. You know, in your old house, you've got to maintain it.
Yeah.
You got to fix the thing up. You got to modernize it. You got to make it better. And you know what? People talk a lot about, you notice they never leave when they come home. Right? You notice they never leave when they come home. And I've met so many people who came home during the pandemic for reasons of elderly parents, reasons of this, reasons of that. They're still here. Something's going on. What is it?
Something is going on.
Something's going on. The buzz in this city, even though, you know, Chris Souter, well done to the guy for actually saying it, right? Even though Royal Avenue looks worse than it did during the Troubles, right? Even though parts of this city have been terribly neglected, there's something going on. Something changing. You can feel it. It's in the streets. It's there.
What would you say to the person listening who can feel it but doesn't know how to take part in it?
I just do
do something. Just do something. Whatever stupid idea. Seriously, whatever dumb idea you think you shouldn't do, it's the first thing you should do. Do you know, just do it. Just fucking do it. Just, you know, that's the heart of successful places, is just fucking do it. Right? Yeah. Go ahead and do it. Right? And, you know, find idiots like me who'll try to help. Do you know? There's plenty of them. There's loads of people willing to help. You just have to say it. And do you know what? The thing I would change here, like if I had a Thanos moment and I could click a glove, you know, the conservatism, I would change that. The unwillingness to speak up, say what you want, I would change that tomorrow. That would be my Thanos glove. And that would change everything. And that's the thing we cannot pass on to young people, is the idea that it's fine to just sit there and not ask for what you want. No, fucking ask. Because if you don't ask, you're never going to get it.
Mm.
And I don't want to hear about it if you didn't ask.
Right.
You know, don't be meeting me in 5 years and going, well, you know, Belfast, you didn't ask. Your problem, not Belfast. Don't be putting it on Belfast. You didn't ask. You didn't get. Simple.
Yeah. Marty, that's a great way to end. Thanks for your time.
No worries, man.
Appreciate it.
All right.